across the ether at the speed of light. It's the Mortgage Moment with Mark Wells and Kerry Deese of Preferred Financial Services, your source for mortgage lending in our listening area. Join us for the next hour. We're going to take a look at the definitions and at acronyms associated with the mortgage industry. Well, Kerry, I always tell people when they walk in and they kind of seem a bit overwhelmed by the mortgage process that I could not go into their job and do their job today without asking a lot of questions and having a lot of things explained. So it's no problem if you feel a little bit uncomfortable with all of the ins and outs of mortgage lending. Every industry, every job has its own vocabulary, has its own set of words, and then those famous acronyms for describing certain aspects, but the mortgage industry is covered up with them. I would say that other than the U.S. military and perhaps the federal government, that mortgage lending probably generates more acronyms than any other industry out there. And beyond those secret combinations of letters, it has a vocabulary of its own, and sometimes it just makes charting the mortgage world difficult. So we're going to try to simplify this. We're going to push back the veil, explain what all those mortgage terms mean so that we can edumacate all of our audience here.
That's another word we're going to add to the dictionary.
Edumacate.
Edumacate.
We want to edumacate you in all these terms. I've got to give a shout out this morning to Reza. Reza called in this week, said he listens to every one of our radio shows. I said, anyone that can get up that early, he's a good man.
I think we're up to about five people
I
now.
I think we've got five loyal listeners now. And we're building, slowly but surely we're building. All right, so I thought we might start first with vocabulary words and actually start with one that everybody knows, but the truth is they only think they know, and that is the word mortgage itself. Kerry, what would you say most people think of when they think of the word mortgage?
The what they owe on the property.
That's right. They think, well, I got a mortgage. So what they're thinking in their mind is I got a loan. So they associate mortgage with a loan, but that's absolutely not the case. The note is the instrument that details how much money you're borrowing and what the payments are going to be to call it back. So really, you thought all these years you were getting a mortgage. You weren't. You were getting a note, and you were actually giving a mortgage, because the mortgage is the security instrument that collateralizes the note with the property. So we don't, when we talk about getting a mortgage, we're really not talking in the right way. We actually give a mortgage. And you know what that makes a person when they give a mortgage?
The mortgagor.
They are the mortgagor. That's correct. They are the person granting the security by way of the property. So you, the owner, you, the buyer, or you, the homeowner, you are the mortgagor. And Kerry, what's the other person involved in this?
The mortgagee.
The mortgagee. That is the person or company that receives the security instrument. That's the lender. So you can still go get a mortgage. Don't worry about that. We all call it that. But just realize when you borrow money, you're not borrowing it on a mortgage. You're borrowing it on a note, which is an obligation to repay, and you're going to securitize that note by being the mortgagor and giving a mortgage to the lender.
The mortgagee.
That's the mortgagee. So if we've totally confused you, now we're going to talk about liens. This is not like the Leaning Tower of Pisa or anything. And this is not leaning on the everlasting arms, but this is a lien, L-I-E-N. And Kerry, what is a lien?
It's a claim on the title by anyone who's owned money, or owed money, rather, connected to that property. And it doesn't have to be, you know, there's different types of liens, but in this instance.
That's correct. There are different types of liens. So a mortgage, because it is a claim on the title until certain conditions are met, and the condition is you pay them off. As long as the lien is in effect, it is a claim on the title by that company or by that person. There can also be other types of liens, like Kerry has mentioned. For instance, if you have delinquent property taxes, that is a lien or an attachment or a claim on your title by the tax district, whether that's the county, the city, the state, federal government. Your homeowners association could file a lien against your property if you fail to pay your homeowner association dues. And if you are ever in a lawsuit that results in a judgment against you, a judgment is also a lien. It is a claim on your title. Now, the reason for these claims on the title is that a lien holder is not going to let you dispose of your property unless they are first paid off. So a mortgage is primarily the liens that we normally see. But then as we get into purchases sometimes and even refinances, we can find that there are other liens that have been filed. Sometimes people are aware of them. They should be aware of them because they should have been given notification. But occasionally we see some that people didn't really realize were out there. One of the reasons that you cannot buy a house without satisfying a judgment is that the minute you buy the house, the judgment automatically attaches itself as a lien on your property. So lenders will tolerate collection accounts because technically they're not liens. They're claims, but they're not title claims. But they will not tolerate a judgment being in place, and they will not tolerate a tax lien unless an arrangement has been made to subordinate that tax lien to the new mortgage coming in. So when you buy a house, this is why attorneys and title insurance companies are involved in the whole process of transferring the deed, because they have to assure you that as the new owner, that the title you're receiving is free and clear. Because guess what happens? Carrie, tell everyone what happens to a lien that is not extinguished and satisfied and that deed gets transferred.
Well, it is attached to the property, so whoever buys the property ends up with that lien.
I have heard, what are you saying? I have had so many people say, how can that happen? I didn't owe the money. Well, unfortunately, because it's a title claim, if you inherit a property or you buy a property where the liens have not been cleared, you're just the proud new owner, not only of that house, but of that lien itself. Your title insurance that you purchased through your attorney and all of those protections that are in place keep this from happening. But that is why it's important that everything be done through the appropriate legal channels so that you don't inherit somebody else's problem. When we have a note has a regular monthly payment, and that monthly payment is a constant payment. It doesn't change with a fixed rate mortgage, stays the same for the life of the loan. But that loan has a changing aspect every month, and that is, as each month goes by, the amount of interest you're paying on the loan decreases, while the principal that you're paying increases. What's this term called, Carrie?
That is called amortization, and we'll ask you how to spell that at the end of the show.
That's right. And if you can pass, you get today's prize, which I don't know what that is, but call me and we'll find out. Amortization is the fancy term that describes this process by which, in making a constant monthly payment, the amount of interest you pay each month is decreasing and the amount of principal is increasing until the loan is paid off. And we just talked about buying a house, and there's a special instrument that is used to convey the title from the person you're buying it from to you. What's that called, Carrie?
That is called a deed.
That's right. Now, people mix up the terms deed and title. Some people may say, well, I've got a deed to the property. Some people might say, well, I have title to the property. In certain ways, they're the same thing, but the deed is actually the physical instrument that enumerates the transfer and the conveyance of the title on real property from the seller to the buyer. When we get back off the break, we'll cover some more terms you need to know in charting the mortgage industry. Thanks for joining us this morning. We're looking at vocabulary terms and acronyms that are part of the mortgage industry. It kind of help you chart your way through when you begin to buy a house and people start throwing fancy words at you. We're going to edumacate you so you will be able to talk our language. Carrie, we just talked about a deed, that a deed is an instrument that is used to transfer the title of real property from one owner to the next. And that means that somebody's giving a deed and somebody's getting a deed. So what is the person giving the deed called?
If you're giving the deed, you are the grantor.
That's correct. Which makes the receiver of the deed?
The grantee.
I like the word grantee. That sounds like a grandee, like somebody that's really important. So we have a grantor, the person conveying the property, a grantee, the one receiving the property. And if the grantee is getting financing, then the grantee is the mortgagor, right?
Right.
All right. We got that down pat. There is a term that sometimes comes into play with, it's associated with the deed, and that is the plat. Carrie, what is the plat? Is it the deed?
No, it's the map of the property showing the locations of the property lines.
Okay, so this is like a physical drawing that shows the boundaries of your property. How are the lines of a plat determined, Carrie?
By getting a survey.
That's correct. Survey is the process by which the plat is actually produced, and the survey uses what is known as meets and bounds. That is simply the property lines that were drawn up a long, long time ago. Now, years ago, I was involved with some property up in the mountains up towards Panther Mountain, and we pulled up the deed, and the deed had been in the family system for a long, long time. I'm talking 150 years at the time. And I was actually looking at the original deed, and it would read like this. It would say, starting at the rock next to the creek down by the down by the big oak tree. Of course, the oak tree was gone by now. But all the old meets and bounds were actually surveyed according to rocks and trees and creeks and all of those things. In our day and time, we have a satellite system. And the entire United States has been surveyed from the space, from the sky, with satellite surveying. This actually saves our borrowers from having to get a survey. You know, back when I started in the business, probably between 89 and say, the late 90s, every transaction we did either had to have a survey that was recorded at the courthouse that we referred to, or we had to get one. And that cost anywhere from $200 to $300. Back then, it'd probably be more like $500 or $600 now. But thanks to the geodetic surveying that's done by satellite, we don't really see many surveys anymore. Occasionally, we'll have to get one on a new house because what does a survey also help us with, Carrie, other than just identifying the property lines?
Anything else that could run through the property.
That's right. Like what? What would be something you don't want running through your property, or at least you want to know where it runs?
Roads or utility lines.
Yeah, right away. Like that. That's right. One of the really, you see a lot after 30 years, one of the really bad situations, we did a refinance on a house up towards Hendersonville. This was probably 20 years ago. And the attorney was checking everything out, and he found out that there was actually a railroad right of way that had been granted in 1878. The tracks had been abandoned somewhere in the 20s, 1920s, but no one had ever abandoned the right-of-way legally.
Oh, my.
So this train ran right through the living room addition that had been put on this house and created an enormous problem for the owner. Literally, the railroad had the right to tell them to tear down their living room because it was on their right-of-way. So your surveys also identify any kind of right-of-way, roads, utility easements, things like that. And they can be pretty important. Most of these things are all now electronically. We rarely see a survey. But if you ever have to have one, your surveyor will produce a plat, which you can then look at to see where your property lines go.
Does that make you the surveyee?
It could be that you are, if you're the surveyor, you are surveying, and you may, could be the surveyee if you received it. All right, now we get to the word that goes along with deed and is often interchanged with deed, and that is title. Carrie, what is the title in real estate?
The title defines the particular rights that an owner has in regards to the property itself.
That's right. And believe it or not, you can have a deed, and that deed is singular. It is conveying a particular piece of property, but it may convey it under many different manners in which title can be held. So, for instance, you could have a deed, but you might hold title as a joint tenancy, meaning you own that property with someone else. So the deed describes the property that's being conveyed, but the title says, hey, you don't own this all by yourself. You own it jointly with someone else. Or your title that you hold may be fee simple, meaning not only do you own the surface of the property, but you own the property below it. You own the mineral rights or what is underneath the ground of your property. You can hold title in things like life estates, where you have conveyed your property by deed, but you retain a right to use the property until you die. So there are a lot of ways of holding title, whereas there is really only one deed. The deed describes the property itself. The title can be held in many different ways. When you purchase a home, you purchase a title insurance policy. And it's mandatory if you have a loan. You have to carry a title policy that will protect at least the lender. But Carrie, tell our listeners what a title insurance policy does.
It protects against you selling the house later and finding out that there were liens attached to the property that you didn't know about.
And it actually protects you as the owner from any adverse claim that might arise that would question your clear title. And that could be liens. But, you know, we don't think about these things until they happen. But we had an enormous title insurance issue about 25 to 30 years ago when the Catawba Indians claimed that the treaty that they were forced to sign that deeded their tribal lands to the settlers at that time was, in fact, a faulty transfer because they were defrauded in that property transfer. Simply the fact that they brought the lawsuit brought into question everyone's ownership in the upstate of their property because the Catawba Indians had originally owned it. And when you buy property, when you get your title, your attorney has looked back to see who originally owned this property before you did, and who before that, and who before that, and who before that. And this is called the chain of title. Your chain of title is the historic record of the conveyance of this property, of this deed, from one seller to the buyer over the years. And the chains of title in our country go back usually to the 1700s, because that's when we were founded and when this real estate got divided up. Well, when the Catawba Indians claimed that the treaty that defrauded them of their title lands was a fraudulent deed transfer, then all of a sudden everybody who owned property that was originally in the chain of title to the Catawba Indians, it was questionable whether they really owned their property or not.
Wow.
And it was a mess. And the federal government stepped in to settle that, or else there would have been a lot of title insurance claims from a lot of people, and we would have had bigger troubles. So your title insurance protects you against any adverse claims. More common claims that we see have to do with estate settlements and estate distributions. For instance, a neighborhood of River Falls here in Duncan, years ago, the property was an old family farm that was sold to the developer, and the heirs of the farmer who had sold the property to the developer, there were some heirs that were not included in the will. And later on, after the developer had developed the property and obviously was making money, and the other heirs had benefited from all of the development, some heirs who were left out challenged the will of the original farmer. Well, that challenged the transfer of the property to the heirs, which then that means that challenges the transfer of the property to the developer, which means that then it was challenged the transfer from the developer to all those homeowners. So there was a giant title insurance problem in that neighborhood that, again, was settled. Everything was fine. Title insurance covered any losses. But chains of title and title insurance and all of your deed and your title and how that's held is so important because you want to make sure you really do own what you think you own and that nobody else is going to come along and claim that it belongs to them. Always in all mortgage closings in our listing area, closings are done through an attorney or through a title company so that all of these things are protected and guaranteed. But they're important vocabulary, important words to know. If we turn back towards mortgages, Carrie, when you make a mortgage payment, your payment is divided into two things. What are those two things?
Principal and interest.
Okay, and what do those mean?
The principal is the portion of the note that's being paid, and the interest is the lender's profit on the money that they've loaned you.
Okay, and we talked before that amortization means that as your mortgage ages, as you make more and more payments, you're always paying principal and interest each month, but the interest portion decreases and the principal portion increases with each month until you've paid it off. There's another term that people ask us a lot about and what it means and what it is, and that is escrows. Now, when we think about a mortgage, people think, well, escrows are taxes and insurance. But actually, that's not the definition of what an escrow is. What is an escrow, Carrie?
It's money held in an account for you by a third party to pay your obligations.
Okay, and that is, by legal definition, an escrow account is money that is held in trust by another person on your behalf to pay your bills when they come due. So with a mortgage, your escrow account is held by your lender. They collect a monthly amount from you for the property taxes and the homeowner's insurance, and then they pay those bills for you when they come to you. Now, what happens, Carrie, if you've been escrowing all this time and you sell your house? What happens to your escrow account?
Well, anything that is left in that account, left over, gets refunded to you.
It gets refunded to you because it's your money.
Right.
It's not the lender's money. It's money that they have held on your behalf to pay your bills. So don't forget, if you sell a house or if you refinance a house, you are due by law a refund of your escrow sums, what's left over in the account, that must be sent to you within 30 days of your closing. When we get back off the break, we'll keep going with vocabulary terms.
We're back to thoroughly confuse you with more vocabulary words and acronyms. If you are confused, give us a call, 864-235-9596, or email us at themortgagemoment@gmail.com.
Thanks, Carrie. We can dispel a lot of mysteries with a simple phone call. Answer any questions you may have. We're talking about terms in the mortgage industry, a term that comes up all the time is discount points. Everyone wants to know, well, what is a discount point? How much is a discount point? What does it do? So, Carrie, tell our listeners what a discount point is and what it does.
It's a sum of money that can be paid to buy your interest rate down.
And how much is a discount point, one discount point?
1 point is 1% of the loan amount. So okay. If you have a $100,000 loan, 1 point is $1,000.
That is correct. And just approximately, how much will 1 point most days buy a rate down?
About a quarter.
Yeah. And so you have to ask the question, well, should I pay a discount point to get a better rate? We'll take the mystery out of that for you too, folks. You got to wonder, why does a lender let you buy your rate down? And you know they're charging for it, but what did they base that charge on? If you do the math, you'll find that it takes you about 5.5 years to recover in lower payment what you paid to get the lower payment. And guess what? That happens to be the statistical average lifetime of the average 30-year loan. So what the lender is doing in letting you pay a discount point is they are pre-collecting the interest differential for the 5.5-year statistical life of your loan. They come out okay because you'll be a statistic in the long run. You may be on the short end, somebody else on the long end. But in the end, the lender will make all the interest that they would have made at the original rate that you paid, that you got, that you did not buy down. Sometimes it's wise if you know you're going to stay in a house, you know, longer than 5.5 years and you're quite certain you won't refinance, paying a discount point can make sense. But sometimes it does not, and you don't want to. We can always help you with that decision if you want to give us a call. Carrie, we banner this one around, and nobody knows what it is. We talk about conforming loans. Conforming to what? And what in the world is a conforming loan?
Well, conforming loans and conventional loans, they're kind of interchangeable. They conform to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's requirements so they can be sold to those entities.
Okay, so we could interchangeably use the word conventional loans and conforming loans, and they're all the same thing. They're any loan that meets Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac requirements for delivery. So is a VA loan or an FHA loan a conforming loan?
No.
No, it's not. And neither is a USDA loan.
Right.
There's also a category of loans that looks a lot like a conventional loan, but it's not really, and that's a jumbo loan. Now, jumbo loans are called non-conforming. Why are they called non-conforming? Because you can't sell them to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Why is that? Because Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have set a loan limit that they're willing to buy. What's that limit right now, Carrie, for our area?
It's 453,100.
It is. I wrote down 453,200, and you corrected me already. So thank you for that. The current conforming loan limit in our listening area is 453,100. If you go to 453,150, folks, you have just gotten a jumbo loan. You may not want to go there because jumbo loan rates are slightly higher than conforming loan rates. But sometimes you need a jumbo loan. And we book, out of our brokerage, we book Fannie, Freddie, and jumbo. Sometimes we'll structure a loan with a Fannie Mae conforming loan and a small second mortgage just to avoid the jumbo rate charge. Again, we can help you analyze your particular situation as to which is better to you. But remember, conforming loans are conventional loans. Jumbo loans are non-conforming loans. And you'll pass the test at the end of the show. Now, Carrie, when someone signs a contract to buy a piece of property, they're supposed to put up something called earnest money. What is earnest money?
It's the deposit you make with your contract offer to make the contract an enforceable transaction.
That's right. Believe it or not, in South Carolina, if you sign a real estate contract and there is no earnest money, you might have a legal contract. That is, it's not illegal to agree to buy something. But you don't have an enforceable contract, meaning if you get to fighting with each other before the sale takes place, neither of you has a legal has an enforceable contract. The court will simply throw it back out saying there was no earnest money. Sometimes earnest money is called consideration. But if you don't have earnest money, the contract is not enforceable. Your realtor is always going to make sure, you know, there's some earnest money. Sometimes people call me up and say, well, how much earnest money? And, you know, that's there's no real hard set guideline. $10 is considered enough to make it enforceable, but then your seller might not really think you're serious with the $10 earnest money. We usually see around $1,000 on smaller transactions, maybe up to $2,000 or $3,000 on larger transactions. Any amount above $10 makes your contract enforceable, so you will be paying earnest money when you make a contract offer. Term that gets thrown around a lot in the mortgage world is equity. Equity is the ownership interest in a property. Your equity in a property is whatever the property is worth minus whatever you owe on the property. If you have a $200,000 value to your house and you owe $100,000, your equity is $100,000. Equity becomes important in computing your loan to value. Your equity is the value that you own above what you owe. Now, Carrie, I want to go over two types of valuation. One is the assessed value of a house, and the other is the appraised value of the house. And I find a lot of confusion over this. What is the assessed value of a piece of property?
That is how much the taxing entity says your property is worth.
Okay, exactly. So your house may be assessed for $200,000, but it may appraise for more or even less. So what is your appraised value?
That is the market value of your home based on a comparison of recent sales that are like your property, called comparables.
Okay, so when you transact a mortgage transaction, a purchase loan, you're going to have to get an appraisal, not an assessment. Now, people all the time when they're refinancing will ask me, well, what happens if my appraisal is higher than my assessed value? Is the county going to up my assessed value because of the appraisal? Carrie, does that happen?
Sometimes, but not necessarily.
And it can't really happen unless you walk down to the county tax office and hand them your appraisal, because an appraisal is not public information. And this is another thing that you should realize when you're going as a seller, as a buyer, as a homeowner who refinances, the appraisal belongs to you and you alone. Now, if your appraisal comes in less than your assessed value, you can take that appraisal down to the county and appeal your assessment. And we've done that many a time, especially after the crash when property values went down. We actually helped lower people's taxes because their market value was not what the county was assessing it at. The other way around, you don't really want to go down there. You don't want to go down there with a higher appraisal and ask them to raise your assessed value. Just let the sleeping dog lie and your taxes will remain the same.
I will say, though, that when you're purchasing a home and the attorney calculates your taxes, they will go off of the appraised value or the purchase price of the home when they're working on setting up your escrow account. So you may see that.
And that's to prevent your escrow account from having a shortage of funds. Typically, we find in the listing area that we're in that assessed values will be less than the appraised value.
Right.
They usually run about 10 to 15% under the market value of the house. But you're right. The attorneys don't want your escrow to be short, so they will go ahead and set up your initial escrow withholdings to be what the taxes would be if they were using the appraised value. If you have an overage in your escrow account at the end of each year, the lender is required to either refund that money to you or, with your permission, to apply that to the principal balance of your loan. Again, that escrow money is your money. You can do with it what you want to do. All right, so we've covered a lot of vocabulary ground, and now we're going to move into acronyms. As I said, apart from the military, where you can go AWOL and everything can be FUBAR'd, probably nothing has as many acronyms as the mortgage industry. So we're going to start with FNMA and FHLMC. And who in the world are these guys, Carrie?
They are the Mac Daddies of the mortgage world. Fannie Mae,
right.
Freddie Mac.
So FNMA is Fannie Mae. I never have known where in the world did Fannie Mae come from. I guess the FN and the MA, but I don't know who decided that's what it would be.
Right, right.
Fannie Mae. And Freddie Mac, I mean, FHLMC, that's the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation. I don't know how that became Freddie Mac, but Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are the two big Mac daddies to know of your acronyms. Now, how about our other friends, FHA, VA, and USDA? What in the world do those things stand for?
Those are your government agencies that insure most of the loans not made by FNMA and FHLMC.
That is correct. And who is FHA?
The Federal Housing Authority.
Hiding behind those letters is your Federal Housing Authority, VA.
VA is the Veterans Administration.
The Veterans Administration in USDA?
United States Department of Agriculture.
That's correct. And if you want to get a bonus point on your test, USDA loans are also RDA loans.
From the Rural Development Authority.
That's correct. USDA makes RDA loans. We'll see you back after the break. For sticking with us. By now, you are getting edumacated. And over the next 15 minutes, you will be completely edumacated and know everything there is to know about mortgage terms, vocabularies, and acronyms. We're going to talk about ARMs. Carrie, what in the world is an ARM, other than the obvious?
An adjustable rate mortgage. And the first time I heard that term when I first started in the industry, I was like, what in the heck is an ARM?
I know. So an ARM is an adjustable rate mortgage. That means that the rate can adjust sometime down the road. Kind of have to watch out for those. How about a leg?
A leg?
A leg.
A leg.
We got arms. Don't we have legs?
I think you're pulling my leg.
Oh, I'm pulling your leg. There aren't any legs in mortgages.
I don't know why.
Yeah,
it just everything
costs,
else.
Well, it costs an arm and a leg to pay it back. So all you need to know is arms. You don't have to worry about legs in mortgages. All right, here's a big one, because you can flip this one frontwards, backwards, sideways. Say it any way you want to. PMI. What is PMI? It's also MIP.
Private Mortgage Insurance.
And it's MI. That's right.
Right. And MIP is Mortgage Insurance Premium for FHA loans.
And MI?
Just plain old mortgage insurance.
So PMI, MI, MIP. These are your acronyms for your mortgage insurance. Now, you know what? Everybody walks away thinking, boy, I just got mortgage insurance. If something happens to me, I die, my mortgage gets paid off. Is that right?
Not so much.
So private mortgage insurance doesn't insure the borrowers against anything?
Nope.
It actually insures the lender. It insures the lender that in the event they foreclose on the property and lose money in the sale, the private mortgage insurance company will pay them their loss in the foreclosure sale. So PMI does not insure you against anything. However, it allows you to buy a house with less than a 20% down payment. And the reason for that is most foreclosure sales will recover about 75 to 80% of what a house is worth. And the PMI covers the lender in the event that they lose money in the foreclosure sale. Now, we've added something to PMI lately, and that's LPMI.
But you can't have LMIP.
There's no LMIP. There is LPMI. And it doesn't cost you an arm or a leg, right?
No.
Okay. So LPMI is what?
Lender-paid mortgage insurance.
And this is a fancy way of saying you have no monthly PMI payment. And how do we do that, Carrie? There's actually products out there that you can put less than 20% down and not have to pay a monthly PMI premium?
You can, but it's not free.
It's not a free lunch. There's nothing out there in the market that's really free. However, LPMI can be an excellent choice for someone with significantly better credit scores. For instance, what the lender does is agree to go with a highly limited mortgage insurance coverage. They purchase that premium up front for you, and they charge you a slightly higher interest rate. In general terms, and if we would take a $250,000 house that would have a normal PMI premium, what will happen is that the higher rate will boost the payment by about $40, but it will eliminate a $100 PMI premium. So if you have good credit scores, ask us about the LPMI option, or what we prefer to call the no PMI option. We have that. Okay, Carrie, back in our vocabulary, we talked about principal and interest, which is PI. But now we've got another acronym, PITI. What is the PITI?
That is your principal, interest, taxes, and insurance.
That's right. So the borrowers want to know, what's my monthly payment? But they don't usually just want to know, well, what is my loan payment? They want to know, what monthly payment am I going to have to make when everything is considered? And if you're escrowing and including taxes and insurance, then what you're asking for is, what is my PITI? That is my total mortgage payment with everything thrown in. Principal, interest, taxes, insurance, and PMI, if there is a PMI premium. So we will always be straightforward with you. When you ask us what your monthly payment is, we'll give you everything. Along with PITI is DTI. What is DTI, Carrie?
That is your debt-to-income ratio.
And what does that mean?
That is the amount of debt you have against how much income you make.
And what are debt ratios used for, your DTI? What's it used for in underwriting?
You have to be under a certain percentage in order to qualify.
So it's an affordability index.
Right.
It restricts your debt from swamping your income, mm-hmm. creating a financial problem. So your DTI is one of the most important acronyms in underwriting. It's probably, next to just credit scores themselves, one of the most limiting factors in the underwriting process. We've got a new acronym that just popped in a few years ago. It replaced the GFE, but it's called the LE. And what is the LE, Carrie?
That is the loan estimate.
And what does the loan estimate do that the GFE used to do?
It breaks down all of your estimated fees, and it shows your monthly payment, escrows, all that good stuff.
That's right. So your LE is your initial loan estimate that is given to you when you formally apply for a mortgage loan that outlines all of the costs that you should encounter in your transaction. That would include down payment money, closing costs, prepaid items, which are your taxes, insurance, escrows, interim interest. Everything should be on your LE. Certain fees in the LE are not allowed to be changed after that so that you don't have a surprise at closing. Some fees on an LE are, as the E indicates, they are estimates. At the very beginning of your application, your lender may not know exactly what the property taxes are on the specific house that you're buying. So he will estimate that. He can't know what your insurance premium is going to be. You may choose one of 15 different deductibles, and that premium could be anything, but he will give you an estimate of what it should be. Those estimated items might change, but there are fees which are not allowed to change and protect you, for instance, from having to pay additional origination charges to your loan and settlement charges when you get to the closing. The LE ultimately turns into a CD. So I guess you plug your LE into your stereo as a CD and it plays back things. Is that what it does?
What's a CD? I've never heard of that.
The CD, the closing disclosure.
Okay.
Yeah, so the LE becomes a CD, right?
Eventually.
Okay, so what does a CD do?
The CD finalizes all of those estimates that were on the LE.
That is correct. So you must receive your CD how long before you go to closing?
3 days. And this is a federally mandated rule. We can't change it.
That's right. We get a lot of pressure sometimes. We're running down to the wire. Why can't we close? Why can't we close? Why? Well, we now have several sets of waiting periods. One of those mandatory waiting periods is we have to tell you exactly what you're going to bring to closing at least 3 business days before you get to closing. And that is by issuing your CD. You have to acknowledge receipt of the CD, and then the clock begins to tick, and then you can close. So this is why getting a loan closed sometimes in a 30-day period is a really tight thing to do.
Yep.
Very difficult to get done, because there are some mandatory waiting periods on the front end, too, that add another 3 business days. And then when you add these at the back, you basically lose 6 business days, which can be like 8 calendar days. From the processing time. So, Carrie, a couple of more acronyms, LTV and CLTV. What are these?
Your loan-to-value ratio and
LTV. Yep.
Right. And your combined loan-to-value ratio.
So your loan-to-value is the balance of your loan compared to the value of the home. If you have an 80% LTV on a $100,000 house, you've borrowed $80,000 on a $100,000 house. What does CLTV do? CLTV mean, though, Carrie? Combined loan to value.
If you have a first and a second, mm-hmm. it stacks the first and the second on top of each other to calculate the
That's
ratio.
That's right. So the same $100,000 house, if you have an $80,000 first and a $10,000 second, you've got a 80% LTV but a 90 CLTV, combined right. loan to value. And speaking of seconds, we've got another acronym, a HELOC. What in the world?
A HELOC is a home equity line of credit.
That's right. So when people in general talk about an equity line on their home, the industry calls that a HELOC, a home equity line of credit. A lot of people like these, even if they don't use them. The nice thing about a HELOC is you don't pay anything on it if you haven't borrowed any money on it. You can have a HELOC recorded on your house where you have the access to money if you need it. But if you're not using it, you don't have to pay any money on it. Some HELOCs are set up for interest-only payments for up to 10 years. They're convenient tools to do renovations with, so we see those all the time. Carrie, we have the most dreaded term in the mortgage industry, the UW. Who is the UW?
The underwriter.
Oh. They lurk in the dark, deep recesses and catacombs of the world, looking for ways to turn you down. But don't worry, Carrie is a registered ninja processor. She knows how to fend off these dreaded underwriters who want to turn your loan down. And we get into arguments with underwriters so that they can come around to understand that, yes, your loan really does meet all of their guidelines. They've just misinterpreted something today. So what you want to do with the UW is you want to offer up prayers that they get up on the right side of bed when your file is in their queue so that you don't have a bunch of extra documents to bring to closing and we don't have to argue on your behalf. Last couple of acronyms, AUS. What is an AUS, Carrie?
That is the Automated Underwriting System.
And we consider this to be really critical. Whenever we do a pre-qualification for you, we have included in that pre-qualification an automated underwriting according to the appropriate system. And this gives us about a 95%. We're on go. Everything will be okay. Your loan will go through. It's not a final approval, but it's as close as we can get up front. We do that for you at no charge. Give you a free copy of your credit report when we're doing it. Now, of the AUS systems, there is DU. What is that one, Carrie?
Desktop Underwriter.
And who uses that one?
FNMA or Fannie Mae.
There you go. And then there's LP.
Loan Prospect. Well, actually, now it's LPA.
LPA?
You're behind
on
things,
gosh.
Mark.
Oh, no.
That's Loan Product Advisor, used by FHLMC or Freddie Mac.
And then USDA has its own system. What's it called?
GUS.
GUS, of
the
course.
The Government Underwriting System.
Of GUS. The Government Underwriting System. Thank you for getting educated this morning. Thank you for joining us with the Mortgage Moment. Call us if we can help you with your mortgage needs.